Hello.
Hey.
Welcome to Rosé and DNA. I'm Deanna.
And I'm Renee. And we're two professionals working in the field of genetics.
For episode 11, we are welcoming geneticist and chief scientific officer at Color Health, Dr. Alicia Joe. Dr. Joe earned her BS in biology from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, otherwise known as MIT, and her PhD in biological and medical sciences from Harvard University. At Color, she began leading and managing the business development of research partnerships aimed at increasing access to genetic testing as a population health tool, and now serves as CSO, where she leads the company's scientific mission, which has evolved quickly from a focus on genetics to other health areas, including COVID-19 testing. And if this wasn't enough, in her free time, she also has a black belt in Taekwondo and even opened a Taekwondo school in San Francisco. So, Alicia, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, one of our favorite parts before we jump into your storied past with science and STEM, we would love to jump into the wine review portion of this interview. So I don't know if I'll get started with that, and then I'll pass it along. So I decided today, instead of a rosé, I'm doing a Cabernet Sauvignon because it's been a little crisp in Boston. Actually, the last couple of days, it's been a little bit warmer, but I'm definitely feeling the fall feels. So during this time of year, I always like to go for a nice red. So I have this Kamusha wine. It's actually made by a sommelier in South Africa, Tinashe Nyamudoka. It's actually one of my favorite reds that I go to pretty regularly. It's like notes of oak, and it kind of has like a smoky feeling, but also a little bit of cherry and some berries. So it's a nice cozy wine for the fall. How about you, Deanna?
Well, I did not do my homework like Renee did this week. So I just picked a red wine that we had at our house. It's a Grenache wine. It's written all in French, so I don't know what it's supposed to taste like, but I've been enjoying it so far. It's pretty good. I don't know how many people actually listen for the wine reviews, but I promise next time I'll have a better explanation. And Alicia?
Yeah, I'm here in California, so no wine for me this morning. I'm still finishing my coffee, but I do love to drink wine. And generally, I love to... it depends on sort of the time of the day or time of the week. But during the week, I usually like to have a bottle of Riesling around. It's just something that's really easy and crisp and sweet to drink. And it often is something that I will crack open while I'm cooking dinner. And once you become a parent like myself, I have a six-year-old, you become very good at sort of drinking a glass of wine while cooking dinner, because it's kind of the one time that you have a little bit of time to yourself. I always reach for a Riesling.
Being so close to wine country, do you have any favorite vineyards out there?
I do, actually. So there's this really cute little winery called Hendry, and it's in Healdsburg, up in the Napa Valley, Sonoma region. And I love this little winery because they actually kind of take a molecular biology approach to wine. So instead of coming in and telling you about sort of hints of chocolate or hints of whatever, berries and all these things, they actually try to break it down in a more sort of scientific way, which very much resonates with me. And they talk a little bit about sort of the molecular science behind winemaking. And so I really love going there. The wine is delicious. And it's one of the few explanations of wine that I really can understand. And so I love them. So that's Hendry Winery, if you ever have a chance to visit it.
Very exciting. Fun little fact, you know, the origin of this podcast was actually in Healdsburg, California. We were out at a friend's wedding, out in Sonoma a couple of years ago. And yeah, we were at the family winery that they have. It's called Robert Young. It's in technically Geyserville, yeah. I guess. So we were there, and we just, you know, we're brainstorming and randomly came up with this idea. So that's so funny that you mentioned Healdsburg.
It's a good idea.
Yeah. So let's get started. So something that we always like to do with our guests at the beginning really is to, you know, take it back to their roots and talk about, you know, your early life. And so in doing our research, we learned that you were born in China and came to the U.S. when you were very young, and you were raised by a family in academia.
And you knew from a pretty young age that that was a path for you. So I'm wondering if you could tell us more about what that experience was like, you know, moving to the US and being raised in this setting.
Yeah, it's so interesting. One of the things that I've come to learn is everybody has such a unique upbringing and a unique story. But of course, when you're a child, you don't realize how unique your situation might be. You kind of just assume everybody else's childhood is identical to your own. And so it was really when I became a young adult, and really when I was in college, that when I started to understand, oh, actually, not everybody like started out being born in a different country and then coming here when they were very young. And so for me, it's more that as an adult, I look back at that experience and I realize how interesting it is. But certainly as a child, I never realized how sort of odd my upbringing was. But yeah, I was originally born in China and was in Beijing, and that's where my family is from. And my parents, when I was young, they both came to the United States to pursue higher education. So my dad came to get his PhD. My mom came to get her master's. My father actually came in a Fulbright scholarship. And they both are library scientists, which means they are librarians. And they have studied sort of what it is to be a librarian and how do you sort of curate a collection and how do you catalog that collection? When they first came here to the US, and when I first came to the US when I was 4 and a half, I spent actually most of my childhood in these academic libraries because they've always worked in university campuses working for the university library. So what I would do is I would go to school during the day, and then after school, I would take the school bus and take it to my mom's work. And I would sit in the library and sort of finish up my homework or, you know, goof around. And so I grew up in these very sort of, yeah, these university libraries with their big reading rooms and leather chairs and all this stuff. And that's how I kind of thought that the world was, and I thought everybody must work in this kind of academic setting with these kinds of you know, surrounded by books, and so I didn't really realize at the time that there was anything sort of outside of academia. I just figured everybody becomes an academic because I had grown up so much on these university campuses, and so for me it was kind of a no-brainer, and almost felt like just a fulfillment of destiny that I should also become an academic. And it never entered my mind that I would do anything other than be in academia.
And, you know, we did our homework and listened to your TED Talk, which was from a couple of years ago. And during that, you kind of mentioned you were expected to be good at math. You said you were, quote, destined to be a nerd, which it sounds like a product of your upbringing. Was there a specific point though, because academia is so expansive, was there a specific point where you said, okay, it's going to be science, it's going to be biology, or specifically genetics?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly was very much a STEM-oriented child, and that was some combination of nature versus nurture, in that my parents certainly did encourage me to like STEM, and certainly I was always given opportunities to take math classes and science classes and go to camps and things like that. But I also naturally very much gravitated towards engineering and science and math. And so for me, when I think about sort of being destined to be a nerd, it was really actually the majority of my childhood, I did all sorts of really nerdy things. And so I would in fifth grade, I remember I would go to my mom's workplace after work, and she was just beginning to learn how to do HTML coding, and she had a big book on like how to do this, and this was in the 90s, and I just decided to like learn. And so I when I was that age, I started learning how to write HTML and build a website, and at the same time, my other huge nerdy passion was Star Wars. I loved Star Wars, like still love Star Wars, current tense, not past tense. And so one of the things I did when I was in fifth grade was I built this website. It was a Star Wars fan website, and it was all about like bringing people together and like doing trivia about all the movies and like all this stuff. And it was like a really interesting way for me to develop that side of myself. But certainly made me a little bit nerdy and weird at school. And so it probably wasn't until I was at MIT for undergrad. That was the first time I was like, oh yeah, okay, these people like are exactly like me. They know they are just the same as me in terms of like wanting to spend all their time reading science fiction and fantasy novels and writing websites and doing all sorts of things like this. And so for me, I think the pursuit of biology, the pursuit of science definitely found me. I just was fascinated the first time I ever took a biology course that went into more of the molecular side of things. Just understanding and learning about the structure of DNA and how DNA replicates and the molecular mechanism of that was so interesting to me because it felt like it was nature's way of doing engineering. And I remember very clearly sort of when I learned about the way myosin works and the way that it kind of walks along a filament, I just thought that's so cool that in natural biology, there has evolved a mechanism that is basically like a bipedal thing. It walks, it has 2 feet and it walks along this filament. And it was like just mind blowing that nature could evolve in that way. And so, yeah, very early on in middle school, high school, I was just absolutely sure that I wanted to be a biologist.
I love that. We're all nerds at heart. I mean, it's why we're doing this, right? Like, we just want to talk to other nerds.
I guess, I mean, it makes sense that, you know, you found your way to MIT and you decided to pursue that PhD in biomedical sciences. I'm wondering if you could say more about the path that you took after that, when you were working on your postdoc and sort of deciding on next steps. And I believe you had mentioned that you were pregnant at that time, actually. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you could talk more about, you know, what it was like to switch from more of that academic scientific track mm-hmm. to a different path that was more in the space of healthcare.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think, for the majority of my early career, I was so singularly focused on becoming a professor that it just never occurred to me to look at any other types of career paths. And I think this resonates with a lot of folks who are in academia, which is that academia is a very sort of well-defined path, and it's kind of I call it a monorail, because once you're on, you know exactly where you're going and how you're going to get there. And the path is very well laid out. Everybody has traveled the same path, which is that you go and you get your PhD. After you get your PhD, you get a postdoc, you do your postdoc fellowship, maybe two, and then you decide to go and apply for a junior faculty position, which will eventually become a senior faculty position, which hopefully will lead to tenure. And that's sort of like your entire 50 years of career, like laid out for you in front of you. And then now your job is to go and slowly like walk that path, climb that ladder. And so for me, I was one of those people in undergrad who I was so singularly focused on this career aspiration that I never had the problem of not knowing what I wanted to do or who I wanted to be. I didn't have a hard time choosing my major. I knew I was going to go to grad school. So I never had sort of those moments of indecision that a lot of folks face when they go to college and when they decide whether they want to go to grad school. So I kind of delayed all of that until I was doing my postdoc and really wrapping my postdoc. And it was time to go apply for those transition grants, those K99 R00 grants. Mm-hmm. And I was in the midst of putting mine together and really thinking about how I was going to write my K and how I was going to, what kind of, you know, that's when you have to decide what is the lab that you want to create and what is the research focus of that lab going to be. And it was really the first time in my entire sort of career journey where I was stumped. I knew that I'd always wanted to work in cancer research, and everything that I had done up to that point had been about doing sort of molecular biology and cancer therapeutic research. So I knew that that was the field that I wanted to be in, but I felt like anything that I wanted to pursue felt really very small in terms of impact, in terms of how a patient might actually benefit from any of the things that I was working on. And I was also feeling at the same time somewhat disheartened by the way that academia kind of rewards progress, because it felt very individualistic, whereas I intrinsically prefer to work in a more collaborative team setting. And I just felt like I wasn't going to feel as fulfilled doing this kind of very individualistic sort of pursuit of the next step versus being in an environment where I could be much more team oriented. And so that was the first time probably in my career where I actually questioned whether I should continue on the monorail. And at the same time, I was pregnant with my son, and he's now 6.5. So this was 6.5 years ago. And I was realizing that you don't necessarily have to continue down this path, that you can look outside of academia, that there could be other opportunities. And my son had just been born, and I was very sleep deprived and not making very sound decisions at the time. And that was probably the only reason I even considered looking at other career paths, because it was so predestined for me that I don't think it was very much a hard thing to question this sort of path that I was on. And it really was sort of very paradigm shifting for me. It surprised everyone, from my family to my friends, to my colleagues. You know, I think everybody had assumed I was going to be an academic, and it was really surprising to everybody, including myself, that I chose to leave academia. But it really came down to sort of those two things: wanting to make a bigger impact on patients and wanting to work more collaboratively.
Wow. I love that story. I think that is what happens for a lot of people. Like, you just kind of get stuck in this. I love the analogy to a monorail, and it's very easy in academia, but it's great to hear that, like, in a moment of, you know, having, I guess, what you might say, less clarity, that actually led to it for your career moving forward. Was there anything, my understanding is you went straight from kind of that experience to color. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So was there anything in particular, because there's so many different companies out there focusing on cancer biology, cancer therapeutics, testing. Right. Was there anything specific about that company that made you feel like it was the right move to start this career?
Yeah. It was really interesting the way that I came across color. It was 2015, which happened to be the year that color also publicly launched its first product, which was a genetic test for breast and ovarian cancer that included BRCA1 and 2. And it launched in spring of 2015 in April, and my son was born in March. And so I very much remember sort of being like very harried and like not very clear about what day of the week it was or what day of the year it was. And, you know, dealing with like a 6 week old. And my husband, he subscribes to the New York Times and reads it religiously. And he forwarded me an article about color, because it was their launch day and they had been covered by the New York Times health section. And there was a big splashy article, and it had a picture of Mary Claire King on it. And it talked about this company that was working with Mary Claire King, who was the scientist that discovered BRCA1. And they were going to change the way that patients got access to BRCA testing. And he forwarded it to me, and with a very cheeky one-liner that was, maybe you should work for this company. And I opened the article and I read it, and I remember thinking like, yeah, I should work for this company. And I think there were two things that really appealed to me. One was that working with as big of a name as Mary Claire made me feel like this was a company that took science very seriously. And I think there are a lot of health tech startups and a lot of biotech startups who try to cut corners in order to move fast or launch quickly. And to me, it was really important that this company had decided to work with not only a scientist, but really the most renowned, the best respected scientist in cancer genetics. And that really spoke volumes about the way they thought about science. And then the other thing was that I went to their website. I was very naive. I didn't really know anything about them. And like, it looked like a nice place to work. The people looked really, really nice. Everybody was smiling. And it just felt like this could be a place where I could really find my next home. But yeah, that was really what appealed to me about Color.
Mm-hmm. They had a great marketing team.
Yeah.
So I guess in terms of, you know, your role when you started off at the company, you very quickly became the VP of Research and Scientific Affairs. And so I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about what that type of role is, and then, you know, what it was like to join a company at such an early stage in that type of leadership role.
Yeah, this was, I mean, this was the part of the sort of jumping off the monorail that I had no idea of what it was to leave academia. And the first thing that like very much surprised me when I started working at Color was just how transparent and flat the company was. So the company was about 30 people when I first joined it in 2015. We're about 600 today. So it's grown a lot in the last 6 years. And what was surprising to me is I think when you're in academia, you're so used to there being a hierarchy in terms of the way that you get things done. You know, when you're a technician, you go check with your grad student about what you're supposed to be doing. When you're a grad student, you check with your postdoc. When you're a postdoc, you hopefully have at least 5 minutes with your PI if they can make that time for you. And so you always knew how to funnel your ideas and your information up the chain, but you were never going to go directly to sort of the head of your department or something and say, hey, I have an idea. Like, what do you think about that? That's just unheard of in academia. And the thing that kind of just shocked me when I first started at Color was how everybody on the team was on an equal playing field in terms of their contribution to the company and how their voices were heard. And it comes with both a sense of sort of opportunity, but also this like paralyzing sense of don't say anything wrong because everybody will take it seriously. And at the beginning, I really didn't know how to behave. I felt a little bit out of sorts because I was so used to having that sort of very clear vertical reporting structure that when I joined Color and everything was flat, where like all of our executives, they were sitting at the same desks that the rest of us were. And we were having conversations that were really open and transparent, and decisions were being made where people's opinions were, everybody's opinion was being asked for and taken into account. And I just thought, wow, this is not the way that I'm used to making decisions or seeing decisions made. And so that was one sort of big challenge for me, was to understand what it is to work in an early startup environment. I think it's also probably the best part about working in an early company, or in general working outside of academia, is that feeling of collaboration with all of these other people. You work with a product team, you work with an engineering team, you have a commercial team, a marketing team, but you're all working towards a single sort of goal to launch some kind of product. And that is really cool. And then what it, in terms of sort of carving out my specific area at Color, when I first joined, I really thought, I'm not really sure what my value is here, or what exactly am I doing? How am I adding some kind of, you know, additional value to the team? But I knew the thing that I was very good at, and the thing that I had spent all of my early career training at, was I knew how to publish papers and I knew how to ask scientific questions. And so I thought, you know, okay, those are two skills that I know I have, and I don't know how to build product, and I don't know how to sell things, and I don't know how to market things, but I know how to do this. How do I take this thing that I am confident in doing, how do I make this valuable to the company? And that's ultimately how it started, was just me being introspective about what is the specific unique value that I bring, and then how do I maximize that value in service of the team? And that's sort of where I realized, okay, we can ask interesting research questions, we can have a scientific voice and a scientific brand, and I can help navigate the scientific field because that's where I came from. And that's sort of how I became sort of the lead of scientific affairs at Color, and eventually now I'm the chief science officer. But it all came from sort of that moment of saying, okay, what is the unique value that I can bring to this company and how can I add to the team?
And you did climb up from there pretty quickly. One thing that we're always fascinated by is like how people, I mean, it sounds like they're that communication style at the company was really helpful, but it's always fascinating when people go from academia where we know that there isn't a lot of leadership training and then like climb up these ladders in startup or even in academia. And I'm curious if Color provided any guidance in that, or you just kind of learned on the job from other people. Was there any like systematic way that you gained these specific skills to work your way up to such an important role as CSO?
Yeah, it's so interesting. Leadership is such an interesting concept, and and it's also not a single thing to everybody, right? So everybody leads differently, and everybody sort of internalizes and thinks about what is leadership differently. And for me, I think it comes from two places. One is very, very early in my career when I was an undergrad, I worked as an undergrad technician for Bob Weinberg at the Whitehead Institute. And Bob Weinberg is a big deal in the cancer biology world. And I honestly didn't know that when I first started working for him. I was a freshman at MIT and I had naively Googled cancer research MIT to figure out which professors were doing cancer research. And of course his name came up because he happens to be like the grandfather of cancer, which I did not know. And so I emailed him and I just, you know, I was a freshman. I was 17, 18 years old. And I just said, hi, you know, my name is Alicia. I'm a freshman. I know we have this undergraduate research program. I really love to work in your lab if you have opportunities. Like, is there any chance that we could talk? And he was so kind and so warm. And he said, yeah, just come to my office. He like gave me his office address and was just like, yeah, come, let's have a chat. And I remember sitting in his office and just at that point, I had done enough research to realize that he was like on the short list for a Nobel Prize and all of these things. And I was like, oh my God, like, what am I doing? And I remember sitting in his office and just talking. And I thought it was an interview, but he had already decided that he would be fine having me be an undergrad technician in his lab. And so instead, he wanted to talk about my family and he wanted to talk about like where I came from. And he has a real interest in genealogy. So he wanted to know everything about my family. There was a moment where he kind of conveyed to me that every person has something to learn from somebody else, and that you should never stop learning. And I think that's the thing that really stuck with me. And to me, leadership has a lot to do with recognizing that about yourself and recognizing that about other people. I take leadership from a place of really empathy in terms of what are you trying to do? What are you optimizing for? Why are you here? And what is driving you to be here? And then how do I help you succeed along your line of what you are optimizing for? So are you here to start your career and you know you're interested in working in genetics, or you know you're interested in working for a biotech company? And how do I help build you the skills that you need to go to the next step in your career? Or are you here because you've been in this field for 20 plus years, 30 years, and you want to change it and you have a really clear idea of how you're going to do that, and you think that Color is a place where you're going to be able to make that impact? Then how do I help you do that? And I think as a leader and as a mentor, you're going to get the most out of your team if you can align their goals with the company's goals. And then everybody wins, right? Because then everybody is able to be rowing in the same direction. And so that's the way I've always approached it. The other thing is, a lot of my leadership skills actually came from Taekwondo. So you mentioned that I have a black belt in Taekwondo. I was part of the MIT Sport Taekwondo team when I was there as an undergrad. I started out as a white belt, a beginner in a PE class actually at MIT. And I eventually got my black belt over the the 4 years that I was an undergrad. And then from there, I went on to actually eventually get my fourth degree black belt. During the course of my time there, I was able to become an instructor and to help teach students and help lead students and coach students. And I learned very, very quickly about how to command the respect of a bunch of disparate individuals, especially as a sort of, you know, I was a small Asian girl who looks 14 even when I'm like 25. And I didn't weigh very much because I fought in the lowest weight class. I wasn't physically intimidating. And I certainly didn't look like I had a lot of experience, but I needed my students in Taekwondo to respect me, to listen to me, and to follow my instruction. And I learned very early in doing that how to sort of command the respect of an audience. And I think that's something that has really taught me everything else I know about leadership, is this sort of that experience in Taekwondo. And I actually attribute everything that I know about how to lead a team to what I learned from being a Taekwondo instructor and a Taekwondo coach. So that's where a lot of my sort of leadership skills come from.
That's incredible. I thought you were going to say you took a course or like read a book.
there are also plenty of places like courses and things like that. And actually, one of the things that Color has done a great job of is they also offer sort of leadership coaching and executive coaching. So you definitely learn from that as well. But for me, I think personally, I do spend a lot of time looking at others and saying, what about that leader do I really like? Is it a stylistic thing? Is it the way they talk? Is it a phrase that they use? Is it the way they lead a meeting and how they send emails? And then I like to borrow things from people and try them on for myself. And I think when I was earlier in my career, I would do a lot of that where I would just say, oh, cool. Maybe I'll try that. Maybe next time I lead a meeting, I'm going to try to do exactly like this person just did. And then what you do is it's kind of like being in the dressing room where you kind of try on a bunch of different things and you take the stuff that you like and you leave the stuff that you don't. For me, that's how I developed my leadership style, was that I would just sort of emulate and copy a lot of the stuff I would see. I would try it on, and some of the things really fit well on me. And I felt like, yeah, I can do this. This feels comfortable. This feels natural. And other things I'd be like, yeah, that didn't work. Like it makes me feel like a little uncomfortable. That's not my style. And eventually over time you collect pieces, and then all of a sudden you end up in your unique style of leadership that is recognizably you and is kind of your version of how you lead. And it feels very, very comfortable. It's kind of like that jacket that you never let go of because it fits so well. But for me, that's how I've definitely developed my leadership and mentor style.
Wow. Fascinating. So I guess now that you are kind of at that, you know, C-suite level, the CSO, I'm always curious what that actually means in terms of like day-to-day work. Yeah. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. To a certain extent, it's probably very unique in every company, what the C-suite is working on or what their roles are. Here at Color, one of the things that has always been, I think, one of our strengths is our ability to maintain that feeling of collaborative teamwork and almost like a flat infrastructure, even though we do now, of course, have to have different levels. You can't have a 600 person company that's completely flat. But there's still that transparency, and there's still that feeling of you have access to the executives and can talk to them whenever you want to, and they will help you solve problems. I think being an executive and then being the lead scientist, there's sort of two different things that you have to think about. Being executive means you have to really think about what is the path that the company is trying to to make, and how do you contribute to that? And so that's working with all of your colleagues across the exec team to really sort of help define and shape what the strategy is going to be. And that ultimately works because you have a team that you work really, really well with. And I think it's so important to have that strong culture of sort of working well together in order to solve a problem. So that's sort of the like, how do you run a company kind of side of things. And two, for me, I've learned a lot over the last 6 years about that side of the job, because I certainly did not know how to run a company or how to, you know, think about finances or how to think about, you know, strategy and roadmap and all those things. I've learned all of that here at Color. The other part of what I do is being the lead scientist at the company. My job is really about thinking about the scientific brand and the scientific voice of the company. How does Color come off when people hear about us? And for me, very, very early, I decided that you must always feel that we are scientifically sound and valid. And you must always feel like that we are grounded in the scientific truth of things, especially in genetics. There can be a lot of different ways you go with that. And you can certainly be on the edges of things where things feel a little bit like, yeah, is that real science or is it pseudoscience? Mm-hmm. And I was very, very clear. I wanted to make sure that what we did was always grounded in science. And so to me, then, what I can do or what I do is think about how to enable and empower the scientific team to strive towards that. So how do we always make sure that everything that we build comes from a foundation of truth? And how do we make sure that we are always up to date on what is truth? And especially during COVID, this has been a really interesting sort of dynamic, which is that in the last year and a half, we went from a completely novel virus that we knew nothing about to a place now where we have a 95% efficacious vaccine against that same virus. It's been a crazy 18-month journey from a scientific standpoint. And as the scientists in the company, our job is to keep on top of the science. And I think what's been really, really interesting and fun is that it's really challenged across the board what is scientific communication, because I think that with something like COVID, where you're watching the science unfold in real time, and it's weirdly being covered by like the New York Times, all of a sudden you're having to teach your average layperson about how science is done, which is really about collecting evidence over time. And every piece of evidence or every paper or preprint or whatever that comes out is a pebble on that scale of truth. And the more pebbles on one side, the more you tip that scale. And all of a sudden you start to say, okay, this is the truth, because I have so many pieces of evidence that weigh on this side versus the amount that's weighing over here. And I think the thing about that is, I think as scientists, we know that's how empirically you determine truth. But I think it's been really interesting to teach the world about that. And so I think it's been a really fun time to be a scientist, because I think all of a sudden the work that we do has a lot of impact, but also the way that we communicate it is incredibly important. And that's been a real focus for the team for the last year and a half.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm sure we could probably do an entire podcast with you on your experience with COVID. But other than the science communication aspect of, you know, communicating about COVID with the lay public, what has been the biggest challenge for Color when it comes to setting up a testing lab and basically helping the world like find COVID?
Yeah, it's so interesting. I think the challenge is always that there's so much to do and there's not enough time to do all of it, right? And so it's all about sort of thinking about what are the things that you have to prioritize or what are the things that you have to do first. And this is where I feel like it's very important to be clear about what your goal is. And in addition to what your goal is, I think you have to be very clear about what your unique value that you provide is. And, and I said that earlier as well in terms of thinking about my role on the team, but I think this is true about companies as well. You have to think about what is the actual problem that needs to be solved, and then what can you bring to the table to solve it? And for us, when we first went into COVID testing in March 2020, the very specific problem that we knew we wanted to solve was that there was not enough testing, and that the testing that was occurring was taking too long to get results back. And so at that time, it was that, you know, testing was super scarce. Everybody was like trying to figure out where they would get a COVID test, and it was really unclear how you could get one. And then when you finally did get one, it would take 7 days to get your results back, which of course, as we all know, is pretty useless in COVID, because at that point you've already infected a bunch of people. And so we knew at that time, if we were going to bring a test to market, it needed to be able to return results to you in 24 to 48 hours. And we needed to get as much volume as possible, as quickly as possible, so that we could sort of solve the scarcity problem. And so for us then, when we were thinking about starting the COVID lab, it was making those very sort of fast decisions, because at the end of the day, we didn't have much time to make those decisions, but we were optimizing for those two things. We wanted to have scale, and we wanted to have fast turnaround time. And that really, when you can make decisions that way, when you can say, these are the two things we're optimizing for, it helps you sort of cut above the noise and say, okay, why are we choosing to use this technology versus that technology? How are we investing in instrumentation or space or people? And it helps you align the team on, if these are the two things we're optimizing for, mm-hmm. this is how we're going to make those decisions. And I think that's incredibly important, is to recognize what is the unique value that you want to provide, and then be sort of almost singular about pursuing that unique value.
Wow. I mean, yeah, definitely a fascinating journey in the last 18 months. But, you know, over the last 40 plus minutes, your career has been a fascinating journey. And one of the things that we always like to, before we dive into our rapid fire questions that we always end on, we like to ask our guests what you've been most proud of in your career, looking back, but also what are you most looking forward to in your next steps?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have the same answer for both. The thing that I'm most proud of is the team that I've been able to build. And I think that's something that I'm so grateful and honored for. Anytime somebody chooses to join my team, I feel very responsible for making sure that they have a great experience while they are on my team. But I'm so proud of being able to start a team from scratch and have built it to where it is today, with such incredibly talented and brilliant people who really know how to work together to solve big problems. And I think when I look to the future, that's the thing I really have always wanted to think about. And I think part of the reason that I left academia was because, to me, the human relationships that you form and the value of those relationships and how they interact with you and how they perceive you is really, really valuable, more valuable to me than you know, getting a Nobel Prize or having a unit named after me. And that's kind of where I realized I probably shouldn't be an academic, because I didn't care about those things. I didn't care about sort of those kinds of ways of showing progress. But what I really cared about was the people who I could affect, and people who could affect me. And so when I think about what I'm looking forward to, who else am I going to meet, and how are they going to change me, and how am I going to change them, and what kind of deep relationships am I still going to build in the future?
Well, we actually haven't had that answer before, but I really appreciate that. And I'm sure everyone that works with you also appreciates that. And so just to quickly launch into our rapid fire, because I know we're quickly running out of time. So first question that we have, what is an app or a book or a piece of technology that's changed your life?
So this is going to totally feel like a plug. My husband works for Apple, but the Apple Watch has completely changed my life. It just makes my life so much easier, because everything, like all my notifications are buzzes on my wrist. So I don't miss any texts. I don't miss any phone calls. And I think that makes me a much more reliable person. So that has definitely changed my life.
What is something that you would still like to learn, or some sort of skill you want to develop in the future?
Oh gosh, there's so many of them. And I think one of the things when you become an adult is you have less and less time to sort of pursue new hobbies. My husband's from Spain, and from dating and then marrying him for the last dozen years or so, I've picked up conversational Spanish, and my son also speaks Spanish with my husband. And so I would love to become more fluent in Spanish. I get by, but I get corrected by my son. Like every sentence I say, there's some sort of grammatical error I've made. So I would love to become more fluent in Spanish.
Definitely a good skill to have, for sure.
Yeah. And what is your guilty pleasure TV show?
Oh, this is a good question. So I'm one of these people who I discover TV shows like way later than everybody else. And so like, I'm never the one who's like, oh, here's the trendy TV show that everybody's watching right now. I'm like the person who's like, did you hear about this show that everybody talked about 10 years ago? So in that same vein, the show that I'm currently really obsessed about or started watching is Outlander, which I know like was a thing like 6 years ago.
All right. Well, with a hard stop, we're going to wrap up, but we just want to thank you so much for being here, Alicia. This has been a fascinating conversation. I think just learning about your entire career, especially working in a startup, has been just amazing. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This was so much fun. I really enjoyed it.
One of the last things that we always like to give people the opportunity to do is promote anything that they care about, whether that's a legislation, a charity, any company, anything that you would like to shout out.
Yeah, for me, it's getting everybody to go get their COVID vaccines. This is probably the biggest public health thing that we can make a difference in right now. We will be able to get out of this pandemic if everybody can go and do their part, and that involves going get your vaccine and wearing that mask when you need to wear it. And then soon, hopefully, this will all be behind us.
Yes, an extremely important message. Well, thank you again for joining us. Thanks. This has been so fun.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, we always end on a cheers. So cheers.
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 If you would like to nominate someone to be on our podcast, please reach out to us via Twitter or Instagram at RoseanneDNA or our website, roseannedna.com.
And in the meantime, be well, be empowered, and cheers. Cheers.